Okay, well, we're going to go ahead and get started. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to our APHA Innovation Session on Public Health Institutes Building National Capacity for Health Impact Assessment. Before we get started, we wanted to kind of get a sense of your familiarity with health impact assessment in the room. So if we could just see by kind of a show of hands how many folks are familiar with health impact assessment or maybe had a training. Okay, so we have a couple folks. And has anybody actually done a health impact assessment in the room? Okay, great. Well, we have a little bit for everyone in this presentation. We'll do a little bit of the HIA 101, and then we'll also speak about how do we build capacity nationally for the HIA process. So to get started, we have a few introductions. My name is Erin Marzali. I'm the Associate Director for Member Services at the National Network of Public Health Institutes. And I'm joined by my colleagues, Noelle Dobson, who is an Associate Director at the Oregon Public Health Institute, James Dills, who is a Research Associate at the Georgia Health Policy Center, Maya Pack, who is an Associate Director for Research and Strategic Initiatives at the South Carolina Institute of Medicine and Public Health, and then we have Elizabeth Fader, who is a Health Policy Analyst at the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute. And collectively and individually, we have no relationships to disclose. So a quick walk through our agenda for this session. We're going to start with a very brief overview of the National Network of Public Health Institutes and public health institutes in general, and share a little bit with you about what the institutes are and how they do their work. We'll then go into discussing the training and technical assistance roles that the institutes are playing to support health impact assessment capacity nationally. We'll spend a little bit of time discussing the demonstration projects that the National Network of Public Health Institute has funded on health impact assessment and talk about how they're serving as a home for HIA in their state. And then lastly, we'll have some time for Q&A, and so I want you to kind of think about your questions as we go through the session and reserve those for the end of the presentations, and we'll have some nice time for discussion and then final remarks. So to get started, we want to kind of be on the same page and talk about sort of what is health impact assessment, and I am borrowing from our friends at the Georgia Health Policy Center this slide on health impact assessment. It's a systematic process that determines the potential effects, both the risks and benefits, of a proposed policy, program, plan, or project on the health of a population. And the process really does consider the distribution of those effects within the population with special consideration for vulnerable populations and really looking at health equity. And then lastly, it provides recommendations on monitoring and managing those effects. And, community voice and stakeholder engagement is a critical key component to the health impact assessment process. And we found that often it's helpful to talk about what health impact assessment is not, because sometimes you can get a little confused over what HIA really is and what stage of the decision-making process it is applied. And so HIA is not used to make the case for why a policy, program, or project should be proposed. It's not an assessment that is done to understand the impacts of a program or policy once it has been implemented. It's really designed to hit that sweet spot of when a policy or program is actively under consideration by a decision-making body. And it's a tool to help predict the health outcomes of a proposed policy or project. And therein lies some of the challenge in conducting health impact assessment is that it really needs to be timed appropriately with the decision-making opportunity. We also get a lot of questions about how does HIA relate to other community assessments, such as MAP or community health improvement plans or community health assessments. And really, HIA is very different from those kinds of assessments. And those assessments are really meant to gather baseline data for existing conditions in a community, and a health impact assessment is a very different process from that. Those types of assessments can inform a health impact assessment or contribute to it, but they are not one and the same. So now that we have a shared understanding of what health impact assessment is and isn't, we'd like to shift to discussing how NMPHI and the public health institutes are partnering to build capacity nationally for HIA. So this is us. We're the National Network of Public Health Institutes. We were formed in 2001 as a forum for public health institutes across the country. And our mission is really to support national public health initiatives and strengthen public health institutes to promote multi-sector activities resulting in measurable improvements of the public health structures, systems, and outcomes. And our vision is to really foster innovative public health institutes across the country to improve population health. We are based in New Orleans, Louisiana. We have a satellite office in Washington, D.C., and those of you who are from the East Coast this morning, we empathize with your troubles with storm, and so we're hoping that you all are safe and your families are safe, and we're thinking about you. We have 16 full-time staff at NMPHI, and really our network has grown quite a bit over the years. So in terms of where the institutes are, we have 37 members based in 27 states plus in the District of Columbia in Washington, D.C. And we have about 10 emerging public health institutes that we support in developing a public health institute. And we provide ongoing technical assistance. And we currently have 3 emerging institute grantees that we're funding in Hawaii, Kentucky, and Vermont to develop a public health institute. And additionally, we provide a lot of technical assistance ongoing to our public health institutes. And I'll just say that many of our members don't work just in their state. They have a regional, some have a national, some have an international portfolio of projects. So we really have quite a bit of coverage across the country. So we like to describe NMPHI as an active network, and I realize that the image of a spider web doesn't really say active, but I guess I was thinking of Halloween and thought a spider web would be a good image to kind of depict how we really are very interconnected and interwoven as a network. And the original aspiration for our program for the national network was to create a forum for leaders of public health institutes to share ideas and innovations. And really, NMPHI has evolved into an organization that has served as a national program office for many program areas. And really, the reason we got into health impact assessment is that in 2010, we had a brainstorming session with our emerging institutes. And we said, what is on the horizon in public health? What is something that you really want to grow and build capacity in? And the overwhelming response was health impact assessment. This is an area we see on the forefront. We want to grow our capacity around it. And so we were fortunate enough to have the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation in the room, who were also very interested in developing HIA capacity nationally. And so they connected us to other national partners who were doing this work. So we found it's helpful to talk a little bit about the attributes of the public health institutes to give you a sense of how they do their work and sort of why they are a natural fit for the HIA process. First and foremost, they improve population health, and they really do work strategically to support population health at the national, state, and local level. And they do this through supporting governmental public health. They are a strong collaborator and partner, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment. They enhance organizational capacity. So many of the public health institutes have an emphasis on enhancing the capacity of community organizations to improve project implementation and outcomes. And institutes have created several mechanisms to provide technical assistance and process improvement support, both in funding opportunities and in grant management processes to improve organizational sustainability. So institutes don't simply just re-grant funds. It is a collaborative community partnership that is tied to empowering community partners to enhance their capacity and promote sustainability for community priorities. So it goes beyond just sort of a re-granting relationship. Institutes convene multi-sector partners, and this is a really critical role that institutes play, and this is why they are a natural fit for the health impact assessment process. Institutes convene many different sectors, such as universities, businesses, the media, community-based organizations. They reach out to education, transportation. And so in serving in that sort of neutral convening role, they are a natural fit for the health impact assessment process. They leverage resources and partners very quickly. They provide reliable health information. and health data. Many of the institutes are involved in direct data collection and design and implement data gathering for multiple settings. They provide the use of data for in-depth analysis with different stakeholders. It's another critical role that lends itself to the HIA process. They also support health systems change. And then lastly, another critical role is informing policy change and decision making. And we talk a lot about how the institutes are sort of on a spectrum. Some of our members are into advocacy, and they directly provide opinions and thoughts on direct legislation. They have registered lobbyists within their organization. Some are really more on the educational side, so they focus on educating legislators and policy and decision makers on health and health decisions. So it's really a wide range of capacity there, but overall, many of our members are really involved in informing policy change. So a special word on institute-government partnerships. Institutes work in collaboration, not competition, with state and local government. And state and local governmental health department representatives are also often key leadership in the state and in the start and development of a public health institute. So they serve on the board and also in an advisory capacity on initiatives that are conducted in partnership between an institute and a health department. And institutes also support government by serving as a fiscal and administrative intermediary. They're subcontractors, and some bring in millions of dollars in national and state funding into their state to support collaborative work. And so this is a picture to the left of Mary Pittman, who is the president and CEO of the Public Health Institute. She's with Dr. Mark Horton, who is the former state public health officer for the California Department of Health. Then it's Joe Kimbrell, who's the CEO of the Louisiana Public Health Institute, and he's also our CEO at the National Network. And he's joined by Dr. Karen DeSalvo, who is the City of New Orleans Health Commissioner. And so that is a really strong partnership. And so now I'll sort of conclude with some thoughts about our national partners in conducting health impact assessment work nationally. We have a really strong partner with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We've had a cooperative agreement since 2001, and this has really enabled CDC to work very closely with the public health institutes on a variety of projects. We started an Innovations in Public Health Policy Competition program in 2010. And the policy competition was designed to solicit innovative thinking from the divisions all across CDC who had a project idea or a topical idea that they thought could be served by a policy approach. So they sort of pitched these ideas. CDC internally evaluates those ideas and selects a couple of them to then go out to the public health institutes who then share their ideas back with how to do a policy project. It's really a unique opportunity because it gives CDC divisions a chance to be creative, and it gives our public health institutes a chance to kind of show what they can do. And so that first year of the competition, we funded two health impact assessments at the Georgia Health Policy Center and at the Oregon Public Health Institute. And so that was really kind of the start of our HRA work. We also were awarded a conference grant to support the inaugural national HIA meeting, which we held back in April of this year. We were absolutely overwhelmed by the response. We originally thought there'd be 200 people that would come to that meeting. We had over 500 individuals who wanted to join us. And it really was a testament to the energy and enthusiasm, interest of HIA nationally. And then lastly, we received some funding to support the National Prevention Strategy, and hopefully some of you had an opportunity to see Dr. Howard Coe speak at the general opening session. He mentioned the National Prevention Strategy. It was created by the Affordable Care Act. There are 17 federal agencies that sit on the National Prevention Council, and we have received some funding to provide them with direct technical assistance to use health impact assessment as a tool for implementing the National Prevention Strategy, one tool of many. And so Oregon and Georgia will share a little bit about that work in their presentations. And so lastly, I want to share a little bit about our relationship with the Health Impact Project, which is a collaborative between the Pew Charitable Trust and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Our partnership was formed in May 2011, really because RWJ was in that room with us back in 2010 when we said, what's new and on the horizon. We set health impact assessments, and so they really, made a match with us and Health Impact Project. And I have a picture here of red beans and rice because it's one of our favorite foods in New Orleans. And when I think about how our partnership started with the Health Impact Project, we're very complementary organizations. So Health Impact Project has the content expertise. They've really been working to nationally build capacity for HIA, and through our network of public health institutes where HIA is a natural home and fit, there really has been a great opportunity for collaboration. So we go together like red beans and rice. The activities that we have underway with Health Impact Project involve building HIA capacity through the Public Health Institutes, and our panel of institute representatives will share more on that work. We are co-facilitating the design and implementation of the National HIA meeting. The next one will be in September of 2013. And then we're providing technical assistance together to those federal agencies related to the National Prevention Strategy. So we have an ongoing partnership, and I want to recognize Katie Hirono, is that right?
Yeah.
All right, Katie Hirono, who's with Health Impact Project there in the back and one of our key partners in our work together. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Noelle, who will share with us to kind of kick off our session about training and technical assistance.
Great, thanks. So I am furiously trying to figure out who is the red beans and who is the rice in that relationship. So when I figure that out, I will let you know. As Erin said, I'm Noelle Dodson. I'm with the Oregon Public Health Institute. We're based in Portland, Oregon. We work throughout the state and nationally. And I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about the role that the Georgia Health Policy Center and Oregon Public Health Institute have played in working to build the capacity of public health institutes, specifically talking about the training model that we used. We trained 10 public health institutes about a year ago. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what elements of training we felt were most important to highlight to build that capacity. So I hope you'll get a better sense of, again, the commitment that NMPHI has to building that capacity, and also a sense of how our approach to conducting HIAs at Oregon Public Health Institute has been shaped by our increased role in training and technical assistance. I've said many times over the last year, equally, if not more, I have learned more about HIAs through training others and providing technical assistance than by actually conducting HIAs. So it's been really valuable for us. Really quickly, I want to tell you a little bit about Oregon Public Health Institute. As I said, we're based in Portland, Oregon. We work throughout the state and are expanding our work nationally. We're a small nonprofit. We've been around for about 11 years. A lot of our work is focused on the prevention of childhood obesity, although not all of it. Focusing on policy and systems change, a lot of our initiatives are based around our very strong belief that place matters. And so a lot of our works are focused on the settings where people live, work, learn, play, and pray. So we do work in community settings, in schools and child cares, at work sites and hospitals. And I encourage you to check out our website at orphi.org to learn a little bit more about us. So our work with HIA began in 2006, and really it began after I attended a New Partners in Smart Growth conference and heard the term HIA for the very first time. And there were a couple of us from Portland at the meeting, and we came back and said, what is this? Seems like something we should learn more about. The work that I'd been doing at that time was really connected to built environment and health. And so we were curious, and we started a group of folks who met monthly. And we met monthly for a couple years with the goal of educating ourselves about what HIA was, learning about it, and that work group evolved into what is now the Oregon HIA Network that has over 100 members, and we get together quarterly to build capacity among practitioners in Oregon. We've conducted four HIAs on a variety of issues on proposed streetcar project in the Portland metro area, on a neighborhood urban plan, and most recently we've finished an HIA on funding for our rental housing inspections program at the City of Portland. We began providing training in 2011, and serve on various advisory committees nationally and throughout the state, and are engaged at the national level with the HIA, with the National Prevention Council, which Jimmy is going to talk a little bit more about later. So this is really the outline of my presentation, the main things that I'm going to be talking about today. With the NNPHI training that we held a year ago, we wanted to do something a little different. HIA had been around long enough that there were a number of trainings out there and different models that we'd each attended, and a lot of really good models out there. We wanted to think what was working best with the existing models and what could we add to it to build an even more robust training model, and one that was really tailored to meet the needs of the diverse set of public health institutes that Aaron mentioned. So these are some of the key elements that I'll be talking about today in terms of having a team approach, real-life case studies, extensive screening and scoping, providing ongoing technical assistance to projects after the training, and focusing on core competencies. So this is essentially an outline of what I'll be talking about for the rest of the day. So this is the training that we conducted nearly a year ago in D.C., All right, so who came to the training? I'm not going to read these slides, but I wanted to have them up there so you could get a sense of which PHIs joined us for the training. One element that is unique to some trainings is that it was competitive to get into the training. Teams had to provide an application, and the costs were paid, and we felt like this was important not only because we knew we couldn't train everyone who wanted to be trained just because of capacity issues, but we felt like having the competitive applications increased the sense of interest and accountability for being really engaged in the training. We also required or strongly encouraged teams to have mixed discipline and mixed roles on the teams. We feel that this really added another layer to capacity building. We wanted someone who was going to be hands-on on the project, that was really going to be diving into that HIA, but also we wanted someone who was a leader in the organization that could really demonstrate that the organization had commitment to building capacity. So it wasn't just about teaching one person how to do an HIA, but again, how the organization as a whole could become a home for HIA. We looked for a diverse set of skills on the teams. Some folks had experience with assessment, others with stakeholder engagement, others communications or influencing policy decisions. One thing that we needed to decide early on in developing the training was whether we were going to focus on one case study and have everyone work through the same case study as part of the training, or whether we were going to have teams bring their own projects. And HIA trainings around the country have used both approaches. So there's really not a right or wrong, but we really thought about what was going to make the most sense. And we decided that the best choice was to have the teams pre-screen projects and bring their own individual case studies to the training. This was in part because we were going to issue an RFP and fund a couple HIAs after the training, and we wanted them to get a head start about thinking about developing their actual HIA project. But it does bring some considerations to how you're going to develop the training and how you're going to develop your agenda and set of activities if you have multiple projects going on. We needed to think about how to structure the training in order to get a lot of group time in so that people really could break up and work on their projects, and that takes away time from other things. Even when you're pulling together a two-day training, there never seems like there's enough time to get everything in. So it does change the focus of the training. I wanted to just reflect for a minute on some of the other trainings we've done, not with the PHIs, but the difference between training when teams are each bringing their own projects and you may have 10 different projects in the room versus a training where everyone is working on the same HIA. These are very different types of trainings, and so we approach them really differently. So one training that we conducted earlier this year was on a proposed transit expansion in Hennepin County, Minnesota, and the training was focused a diverse group of stakeholders, some that were going to be very hands-on, some that were not going to be, just varying levels of involvement. And the training really was to kick off the project. So there are a lot of pluses to that because everyone is gathering around the same topic, but there are also some challenges as well. And again, just things that you need to think about when you're developing the training. You may not have the opportunity to get quite as in-depth or detailed about how to conduct each step of the HIA because the day really needs to build in a lot of time for that relationship building and for the group input. So there's just kind of different goals of the day when you have everyone working on the same project. Has anyone in the room screened an HIA project? I know I don't think I saw hands of anyone conducting one, but has anyone screened a project? Yeah?
So I'm going to spend a few moments talking about the importance of screening because really we feel that this is one of the most important parts of conducting an HI, and particularly if folks have not had an experience, I can't emphasize enough how important it is to spend the time to do screening. Probably the most important thing I've learned in conducting an HIA is to take the time to be thoughtful about that. I have two slides here with some of the typical screening questions you ask when you're screening an HIA, and I'm not necessarily going to read through them, but share some of the things that really have jumped out to me. Screening is important because you don't want to get down the road and realize that you've picked the wrong project. It's a waste of resources, and frankly, it's also really frustrating when you get down the road and you realize you're trying to fit a square peg in a round hole. And it also adds to confusion about what HIA is and isn't in the field. So it brings up distinctions about what HIA is as defined as best practice standards versus broader health assessment methods and activities more generally. So it's kind of a gray, squishy line a bit between when an HIA is appropriate and when it really is future health assessment that you need to be conducting. A quick example of this, there's currently a tract of land in Portland that is up for annexation for future expansion of our port. It's called West Hayden Island. The city planners and the environmental consultants came to us and wanted to do an HIA because they'd heard us talking about it and the consultant had like seen it on Google and thought it sounded like a cool thing to do. So they came to us and the health department said, "We really think we need to do an HIA on this." And we didn't agree. We didn't think it really required a full HIA, and so we made a formal recommendation back to the city saying, "We don't think you need to do an HIA. We do think you need to do a little more health assessment on X, Y, and Z, and we'd love to help you with that. But you don't need the full scope of the HIA." So that's what we ended up doing, is some additional health assessment, not an HIA. But yet, in the media and other stakeholders continue to call it an HIA. I just had someone call me the other day and say, "Oh, I just heard on the news about that HIA that you conducted." And so for me, it really brings up this issue of, you know, is that a big deal? Like, is it important that someone calls an HI only when it is or not? Something I'd be happy to talk about more in the Q&A if folks are interested in it. And I'm not really sure kind of where I fall on that yet, because in one hand, if you're bringing health to the decision-making process in a new way, that's really what we want at the end of the day. But then when you think about the credibility of the field and best practice standards, that definition becomes a little more important. So some other screening criteria, we really focus the PHI training on clearly identifying a decision point. Again, a really important point for screening projects. There are new languages when you're working with new disciplines. There's shifting timelines that you often have no control over in politics. It's easy to kind of too quickly think that you understand the decision-making timeline for someone else's project, who makes the decision, who you should target. Using the Hennepin County as an example, again, with the transit expansion, there are really multiple decision points. Early in the project, three or four alternatives are selected, and then those get a draft environmental impact statement, and then, you know, council is going to vote on it. But if you think that that council vote is really the decision that you need to focus on, in many ways, you've kind of missed the boat. So you need to understand all the decision points along the way and your opportunity to impact those. So because the projects were well screened, we had time with the NMPHI training to really focus on the other steps of scoping and assessment, recommendations, reporting, and evaluation. The last thing I want to talk about is we pulled in what we called our HIA core competencies into our training, and this was something that we hadn't seen before in previous trainings. These are issues or factors that aren't one of the five HIA steps, but that we feel are really key to conducting a successful HIA. So we chose to really build this into our training. Sometimes we talk about each of these core competencies or threads kind of along the way when we're talking about scoping. We talk about the core competencies when we're talking about assessment. In other trainings, we've really kind of condensed it and spent a good chunk of time just talking about equity, talking about stakeholder engagement. So I'm just going to share a little bit about these four. Equity, it's an often used but rarely defined or operationalized term, at least in our circles. And our training really seeks to talk about what does this look like? What does equity mean? How do we achieve it during each stage of the HIA? So for example, equity in screening starts with
the project that you pick in the first place. There could be a project that, say, school lunches or diesel school buses that are going to affect a wide range of kids and not necessarily just a particular population, whereas a project on a low-income energy program for seniors is really focused particularly on a more vulnerable population. During scoping, a key equity consideration is what populations are you going to assess? Are you going to really focus your assessment resources on subpopulations that are more likely to be impacted? Communications, not only how you communicate, is it accessible to multiple audiences, but also other opportunities for impacted populations to be messengers in the communications. With stakeholder engagement, typically developing a stakeholder engagement plan is part of the scoping phase, but really the skill or the art of stakeholder engagement runs throughout all those stages. In screening, you know, who is asking for the HIA? Is this an idea you came up with, you know, in your office with your door closed, or were you out there talking to the stakeholders about what was going to be important to them? In evaluation, people don't often think about it, but stakeholder engagement and communication is really closely linked to your evaluation plan. At the end of the project, if you want to evaluate how your work impacted the attitudes, knowledge, and behaviors, you need to have had a stakeholder engagement plan that reached out to those. We've seen too many times where the evaluation seeks to measure, did we change a decision maker's attitude about the health impacts of housing policy, but yet your first communication with them is giving them the final HIA report a week before the decision is made. Managing the process, may be fairly obvious. There are a set of skills and competencies that are not only, you know, related to a successful HIA, but really all projects, those nuts and bolts of how do you manage multiple stakeholders, budgets, timelines, work plans, politics, etc. And we didn't want to skip over these elements in our training. One of the things we always talk about is memorandums of understanding or collaboration agreements, which is a really, what we feel is a really key element when you're working with multiple stakeholders. Sometimes that's a collaboration agreement with the advisory committee so that there are clear expectations about their roles. Often members of an advisory committee have never been part of an HIA, may not be that familiar with it, so it's important to be clear about that ahead of time. In other cases, you may need an MOU with an agency regarding data sharing. On the streetcar project we worked on in Portland, it was in a draft environmental impact stage, Metro, our regional government, and so we had to have a memorandum of understanding so that we could see that information over a 4 or 5 month period as it was being gathered. If we hadn't had that agreement, we would have had to wait until the public comment opened, and we would have had 6 weeks to do an enormous amount of assessment review of their data. So that was really important. It still also was a little sticky because while we had the approval to look at the data, our advisory committee did not, and so we were limited in what we could share with our advisory committee. So that was a lesson learned from our end. And then influencing the decision. Just because you want to do the right thing, just because you're a great researcher or you have the resources, doesn't automatically mean that you can successfully navigate the decision-making process. We find that to be really important. It relates a lot to the pre-screening that I talked about earlier, about understanding the process, who the decision-makers are, and really assessing what your ability is to impact the decision at any given point. It's also a lot about the stakeholder engagement and the communications. So depending on the group that you're training, it can be useful to do a little advocacy, little A 101 with the integrating that into your training. So with that, I talked a little bit about the training model that we use for PHIs and other practitioners. Jimmy's going to talk a little bit more about the work that we've been doing with some of the federal agencies, which is kind of a whole other approach altogether. So I think Jimmy's next. Great. Thanks. Happy to answer questions at Q&A.
So hi, I'm Jimmy Dills from the Georgia Health Policy Center. We are the Public Health Institute in Georgia, housed in the Andrew Young School of Policy Studies at Georgia State University. Health in all policies and health impact assessment is a small but growing part of our larger portfolio of work there, and I encourage you to go over to the exhibit hall and check us out in booth 3021 if you want to know more about all the different things we do as a public health institute in Georgia. But like Noelle said, I'm going to focus more on the work that Oregon and Georgia are doing with the National Prevention Council, National Prevention Strategy. So Aaron kind of gave a broad overview of it as the 17-department collaborative as part of the healthcare reform legislation, and they've built this cabinet-level collaborative group with all the 17 federal departments, and then they came up with a strategy for how to do that, and they came up with these broad council commitments, one of which is that they'll identify opportunities to consider prevention and health within departments and encourage their partners to do so voluntarily as possible. So under that broad framework is where they're trying to fit HIA into some of the existing work that they're already doing across the country in, you know, in non-health sectors, which is really important when you think about HIA is bringing it to decision-making context where health is not a strong driver already. So through the partnership between CDC and National Network of Public Health Institutes, Aaron said, the point is to give direct technical assistance to the federal departments. Oregon and Georgia were selected as the health institutes to do that, given our existing HIA experience. And so we all kind of picked and were assigned different federal departments to focus our efforts on and really try to build these relationships through a screening process with these different agencies as we identified places where health impact assessment and health and all policies would be useful for their existing work. And so through that process, we settled really on, I think partly as coincidence, really ended up being a lot of projects with Department of Transportation, Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, and EPA, Environmental Protection Agency. So what I'm really going to give is a broad overview of the five projects that are currently ongoing under this work of technical assistance, and two of which Oregon is working on. So Noelle will certainly be able to answer any really specific questions you have about those, and then the three we're doing at Georgia. And I've organized these not in order of importance or completeness or anything. They're really organized by spatial scale to really illustrate the breadth of types of decisions HIA can be applied to. So it starts with the designated housing rule at HUD, which is going to be a national rulemaking process, and then some work we're doing in Vermont with a regional planning grant under the HUD Sustainable Communities Planning Project. So that's a regional perspective. And then kind of a sub-regional perspective in Atlanta with the Proctor Creek Green Infrastructure Plan. So that's kind of at the scale of a watershed. And then moving further down to the Georgia Multimodal Passenger Terminal, which is a big transportation project in downtown Atlanta. So that's a large project scale. And then down to one Oregon's working on with the German Jarena Community Elementary School in Springfield, Massachusetts, which is really a single-site, small-scale project that HIA is useful for. So start with the designated housing rule. This is HUD's rulemaking procedure to designate housing for elderly and disabled persons. And it's formed through their Office of Public and Indian Housing, and it's the rulemaking for public health agencies to designate these housing locations for this. And in the current form, it's recommended that you think about some of the health effects on these vulnerable populations and then also health effects in the communities where the housing is being designated. HUD actually has started to redraft that rule and are moving towards making it a requirement to look at these issues, and that's where the HIA is coming in to look at these proposed regulations for the rulemaking for designating the housing. And it's important that HUD staff identify this rulemaking as a process for HIA because that indicates buy-in from the decision-making body at the start. Kind of what Noelle is getting at with the screening is you don't want to really do HIA in a situation where decision makers aren't going to be interested in what you find and where they're not a part of the process from the start. So having them identify that project or this process as a way forward is pretty important in producing a useful HIA to really start systematizing how you look at those different health effects in the communities and on the individuals that will be moving into these housing units. And this one is also interesting because the Oregon Public Health Institute is working with the Health Impact Project, Pew Robert Wood Johnson, to lead and produce this HIA for HUD. And again, Noelle can expand on this much more than I can. And the one that I've worked more with is the Healthy, Vital, and Strong Communities in Northwestern Vermont, which is the Northwestern Vermont Planning Commission, housed in St. Albans, Vermont. It's a very northern tip right under Canada in northwestern Vermont, and they've got a HUD grant, or the partnership grant between HUD, DOT, and EPA to do sustainable planning, but it's really managed by HUD. They report to HUD, so this one we're classifying as working with HUD, but it is also a good example of the federal collaboration between different departments. And so as this project got identified, we thought it was interesting, but it really wasn't quite the right fit for health impact assessment, because their grant was already written to include health. It's Healthy, Vital, and Strong Communities. That's the title of their grant. They're really looking at how to weave sustainability and health into their existing planning documents and their existing planning process. And so we shifted to a health and all policies perspective, given that health was already at the table and they needed help to really operationalize health and how will that health piece be brought into the sustainability piece as they look to expand their existing general plan with an economic development plan, plan to implement their state-level complete streets ordinance, a disaster resilience plan, and also creating kind of a community health atlas to catalog baseline conditions and come up with ideas of how to move forward from a health perspective integrated into all those plans. And so we went up there and worked with them to get a lot of the stakeholder groups, really to have a health and all policies training. The major purpose was to get all the different stakeholders in the room together talking to each other from across the region. So you had people from the state level health department, local level health, planning and development partners, some industry representatives were there. We had some people in the room from HUD. So it was really a good opportunity to get everybody together, thinking about these issues, talking to each other, really making those relationships that are required to bring health into these conversations for sustainability and planning. And then the next day we had a more targeted meeting with their community steering committee where we really focused on how they could integrate health metrics into their grant activities and grant deliverables. The key among them is the system of mini grants that they're going to be offering to implement the strategies they identify through their planning process. And so we wanted to be sure that health is going to be a part of that and really got them to start asking questions we don't think they would otherwise be asking in this meeting. And I think it's going to be really interesting as they move forward with these plans, drafting these four plan components and looking at how they're going to evaluate them and do the mini grants. So that's how HIA Health and All Policies is going to be brought into that. And so we're framing HIA as part of Health and All Policies, which I think is an interesting space that the field is in right now, where you get to this idea of calling something an HIA when it's not quite as textbook HIA, but you still want to encourage people to bring health into those policymaking arenas. So working with health impact assessment as part of health and all policies, I think, is a big theme, especially when you're working with these bigger organizations and especially where, you know, EPA or HUD, they already kind of have some health aspects going on in the work they're doing. So it might not be HIA as necessary as just thinking about health in general, and you step out of kind of the six-step process of HIA in that respect. So one in Atlanta that we're working at is the Proctor Creek Green Infrastructure Plan, which is still somewhat undefined. We're working with EPA on this one to look at a very, very impaired watershed in downtown Atlanta. This is an actual picture of them doing cleanup of it, and I have to imagine this is pretty far downstream because it's very urbanized, a lot of impervious surface. The creek essentially is covered as it goes through downtown Atlanta. And so part of the green infrastructure plan is to daylight the stream, add parks, recreation facilities around it, start looking at innovative ways to deal with the stormwater runoff. All these types of things are going on at different levels within Atlanta, within the region, within the city. And it provides an interesting opportunity to think about HIA kind of in the real world. When you train and you think about it, it's somewhat linear process. If you identify things, you work with it. But in this case, they've essentially started to scope some of the things they want to look at, water runoff, stagnating water, impact on vulnerable populations in this area. So the EPA has started to think about some of these health concerns, but the screening process is still incomplete, as in there's not, that specific plan doesn't exist yet. And I think over the next few months, that's going to start to be sorted out. And EPA is very energized about getting that piece done so they can really jump into doing the HIA work, which will be facilitated by the Health Policy Center at Georgia. So it's EPA Region 4, and it's EPA's goal is to utilize HIA to start systematically looking at how green infrastructure can bring health benefits to the community. So again, it's an interesting one where EPA sought this out. I believe this one's through their Office of Research and Development. They offered an internal grant process within Region 4, and I think Region 1 did it. Was it done by Region? And so they identified this as an interesting space for HIA. So when the federal departments are the ones identifying the space for HIA, I think it becomes much more useful because, again, you're getting that buy-in from the key decision makers you're working with. 3 minutes? All right. So Georgia Multimodal Passenger Terminal, it takes me 3 minutes to just say that, is going to be in the middle of downtown Atlanta. It's a big, this is it right in the middle here, which right now is a space called the Gulch. It's just vacant land that is in between some of the sports arenas and the middle of kind of the south end of downtown Atlanta. And so it's meant to bring together commuter rail transit, bus transit, future trolley car light rail expansion, all kinds of stuff in one space. And we're working with DOT on this one through the Federal Transit Administration, which is the lead agency for the EIS process. So this is one where we're integrating HIA into the EIS process. Working with a lot of interesting partners, I think Federal Transit Administration, the EPA, Georgia Department of Transportation, and this is also a big public-private partnership to get this work done. So we do have some private sector partners as well. And we're going to be working specifically with CDC as a participating agency, kind of what Noel was getting to. Once you have these memorandums of understanding as a participating agency, you have more of a right or, you know, entry into working with the data as it's being produced, so we don't have to wait for the public comment period. We can be looking at the data as they're developing it, where they're moving through their final scoping phase with that now, and this is where we're going to start to come in, add some, kind of some technical health documents, and then hopefully get the health impact assessment recommendations and findings sprinkled throughout the final EIS report. And this is one where they've really envisioned it as a demonstration project for how to do large-scale transportation infrastructure improvements from a health perspective. And then finally, at the smallest scale, is this elementary school in Springfield, Massachusetts, that Oregon's working with EPA Region 1 up there on. And there were no like pretty pictures online of it, so I just used the Google Street Capture. And if you turn around from this, it literally is across the street from I-91, major thoroughfare that runs through Springfield, and has severe air quality issues that have been identified. The students in the school have twice the rate of asthma as the baseline population, and in Springfield as a whole is identified as one of the hot spots for asthma in the state of Massachusetts. And so the city's already identified this as a project, as a problem, and has pledged $2 million to start mediating some of those issues through various technological means or whatever. And they sought out the help from EPA to really bring a systematic process to this and start looking at some of the health effects of this, so they make sure they invest that money in the most appropriate way. So this is one where the stakeholders are asking for HIA through a federal department. So it's just another way that HIA can start coming into these issues. And it's an interesting one, I think. Oregon's already gone out there to do a scoping session with them, and I think there was some hesitancy in the beginning because air quality is identified as the major concern. That's really how it started, and that EPA might really want to focus too much on air quality. They have limited resources, don't want to look at, you know, a broader health perspective. But when they actually got up there and did it, they were really interested in that, and bringing all those different stakeholders to that meeting raised a lot of other issues about the health of the students in the area, the health of the community at large. So really using scoping and the existing concern about air quality and asthma really opened the door to look at a much broader range of health concerns in the area. So that's my quick overview of those five projects. There's much more information about each of those, but now Maya and then Liz are going to talk really specifically about some HIAs that they're doing in South Carolina and Oregon, respectively.
Good morning. How are y'all today? My name is Maya Pack. I come from South Carolina, you can tell. I met a friend from high school the other day, and she said, "Your accent is even worse than when I last saw you 10 years ago." I said, "Well, 20 years in South Carolina, and I am now a South Carolinian." So I represent one of the institutes that Aaron talked about. We're part of the National Network of Public Health Institutes, and we participated in the health impact assessment training that the Georgia Health Policy Center and the Oregon Public Health Institute put on just about a year ago. And then we applied for a demonstration grant, and we're one of the recipients along with Wisconsin. And so I'm going to give you a little bit of background on where we have evolved from in terms of our work on HIA. We're relatively new to the health impact assessments, and we're a pretty young organization. We're only 5 years old. So these are the three items I'm going to talk about with you this morning. In 2010, our work with health impact assessment began in cooperation with our state health department. The South Carolina Department of Health and Environmental Control was awarded a health impact assessment capacity building grant by the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials. And in writing that grant, the Division of Obesity Prevention was the lead on that, and they knew that they would not have the capacity to implement the capacity planning for our state, and so involved our institute as a nonprofit neutral convener and provider of evidence-based information as a partner on that. And so together we wrote and received this funding to do capacity planning. So that was the first part of our process. The second part was that through the capacity planning process, we decided, well, the only way we're really going to create capacity is to do one of these things. So we did a health impact assessment on a proposed road project, and so I'll talk a little bit about that. And then finally, this year we received the demonstration grant and are using our time, which ends in about 30 days, to do a health impact assessment on a proposed park, trail, and green space plan as part of a comprehensive planning process for the city of Greenville in the upstate of South Carolina. So in terms of the capacity planning that we did back in 2010, we did this on a statewide level. We convened stakeholders from all the non-health areas that we could engage in this process. And of course, none of these folks had ever heard of health impact assessment. We had barely just heard of health impact assessment. And so we brought folks together to talk about the tool, the concept of health and all policies, and how and if this tool could be integrated into work in our state. And so some of the things we talked about were how to position health impact assessments as a value add instead of just one more thing that we would require or ask of agencies outside of health to do, how to promote the use of HIAs, how to select projects, which has been discussed a little bit in terms of there's a sweet spot in terms of timing in selecting projects and the screening process that Noelle talked about and how important that is. And how most importantly for us as a small organization and in a pretty small state, how to identify resources and develop the capacity to build health impact assessments. So those are some of the considerations, and our recommendations that came out of this process were that we needed to educate decision makers about health impact assessment. We needed to educate folks in sectors outside of health and public health about health and all policies and the tool of health impact assessment. We wanted to establish a mechanism for identifying policies and projects, and so far that mechanism is me. 2 years later, still just me. Consider varied funding sources. So we look at grant opportunities. Sometimes those grant opportunities don't fit into the timeline of projects that we're looking at. So how can we kind of, as we expand knowledge about this tool, how can we also develop relationships with local funders and others so that funds will be available to support us in doing a health impact assessment when a right project comes along. We also talked about how to increase our capacity for data collection and management, which is so key to the assessment phase of a health impact assessment, and how to continue to perform to build the capacity when our organization is six FTEs, and this is just one part of my job, and I have part of one person's help me. So a little bit different than some organizations with a lot more capacity. So the capacity planning process also resulted in this idea that we need to do an HIA. And so we had just a small group. We called ourselves a steering committee, but it was really folks who are already involved in the project. And it was on a proposed road project, which in South Carolina, almost all of the roads are owned by the State Department of Transportation. So that is the ultimate decision maker. But local transportation planners had developed a comprehensive plan, and one of their high priority projects was a road redesign of Daniel Morgan Avenue, which runs through the downtown of Spartanburg, South Carolina, which is also in the upstate and is, I think, the fourth or fifth largest city in the state. It's a small city. And in the green line you can see on this map was where the transportation planners proposed that the Department of Transportation restripe those lines to include a bicycle lane, which did not already exist. And then the orange line represents a road diet section. And a road diet, has anybody ever heard of a road diet? So that was like a thing I was like, what are you talking about? I had no background in transportation. So I got to learn a lot about what road diets were. And the reason that this small orange portion was highlighted to be developed into a road diet was because it's a more densely populated area. But this is what a road diet is. You take a road that has multiple lanes going in each direction, and then the proposal here is to take a four-lane road and turn it into three lanes, one lane going in each direction with a center turn lane, and then create physically separated space for a bike lane, and then add pedestrian walkways, sidewalks on it either side. And so it was a relatively small project. The whole road is only 2 miles long. The proposed or the expected cost of the project was about $500,000. And so we said, okay, this is something tangible we can wrap our arms around, and we developed a health impact assessment on this proposed project. Well, as we were going through the process of the health impact assessment, the funding that had been previously on the table to do the project kind of got taken away. So this health impact assessment exists, and if you're really interested in this particular project, I'm doing a poster session tomorrow at 8:30. So come visit me there, and also there's a full report on our website that you can see. But it was really an educational experience, and it's also one of the things is that with health impact assessments, as with many other new tools, you learn by doing them. So I think the work that we had done there created enough capacity, enough interest in our organization to really be active about pursuing other opportunities. And so the current health impact assessment that we're doing, it's funded through the National Network of Public Health Institutes and the Health Impact Project, is related to a comprehensive planning project that's happening right now in Greenville, South Carolina, which Greenville is the largest city in our state, even though it's not the capital, we're in the upstate, kind of between Charlotte and Atlanta. And we chose to focus on a proposed park, but the city is in the middle of a three-year planning grant, and they're focusing on housing, transportation, parks and open space, jobs, and economic development. So they have a very broad scope of what they're looking at, and we decided we really need to target in on one of those areas. And so there's a special emphasis neighborhood that's adjacent to our very prosperous and robust downtown area that is a low-income and suffering neighborhood, very vulnerable neighborhood. And so the idea is to kind of project some of the success that our downtown has had and keep it going and into this help this area that's adjacent to our downtown. We've assembled a very diverse advisory committee. We have public health represented very well. We have planners of all sorts from the city of Greenville represented. We have a lot of community-based organizations, and we have two city council women. And so it's very dynamic. It's about 25 people. Very interesting process. And as I mentioned, we're about 80% through with the process. We have our last advisory committee meeting next week. And so we'll be finalizing our recommendations about how this proposed park, trail, and open space concept in the comprehensive planning process can be maximized, can be used to maximize health and also create some mitigation strategies for some negative health impacts that have come up during the process. So this is just a map of the planning area, and it focuses on three low-income neighborhoods where there's a disproportionate number of families living under the poverty level, very high level of unemployment, but very adjacent geographically to a prosperous downtown, but without any good connectivity. And so this is a kind of a zoom in of the proposed park area, which has been the focus of our planning. And it's been a little bit of an interesting process, because when you think of a park, you think of all sorts of things that promote active living and positive health impacts. Well, we did a lot of research and collected baseline data, and you know, there's tons of research that says parks are great for people, great for neighborhoods. But we have about 5 community residents also on our advisory committee. And because of the nature of this neighborhood, it's got a very high percentage of folks who rent their homes instead of owning their homes. And so there's a major concern that if a park, a really nice park in particular, is developed in this area, that it's going to increase the property values. Well, that might be okay if you own your home, except for the property tax part. But if you don't own your home, what's going to happen? There's a real concern about displacement. And so in my mind as a public health person, the thinking was, our number one recommendation is going to be do this park, do it big, do it great, do it as fast as you can, and put in all these things to make people physically active. Well, I'm anticipating that the number one recommendation is going to be don't do this park until you have a very strong mitigation plan in place for displacement and gentrification for this area, because that is what we're hearing from the community residents. And as part of being involved in this process, I've been invited to participate on the city's planning team for the park. And they actually have a design consultant already hired. And so as they participate in our process of the health impact assessment, and I participate in their process of planning this park, there's the ability to make the connections and really have them see, not through my words, but from the words of the people around the table, that hold on, you might be designing something a little bit prematurely. So it's been a really fascinating process, and one of the most fun projects that I've ever worked on. And it has led to a lot of momentum. All the things that I've talked about have led to a lot of momentum for our organization in terms of health impact assessments. We did a workshop at the Virginia Public Health Association meeting on health impact assessments last year. Earlier this year, before our current project was launched, we got some funding to do a training locally, and it focused on the Greenville Comprehensive Planning. And so we're able to cultivate knowledge on health and all policies in HIA amongst a lot of the stakeholders that are involved in the park planning and are part of the HIA. And then also as part of working in that neighborhood, West Greenville, we partnered with a number of local nonprofits to host screenings of the HBO documentary, The Weight of the Nation. And we focused on a snippet, it's about 25 minutes long, about food access, which this area is a food desert and has been one of the topics of conversation about how could a park help alleviate the lack of healthy and nutritious foods. And we've talked about everything from a community garden to a farmer's market, et cetera, or even, and this is beyond the scope of a park or trails, but even how to incentivize a supermarket to come into the community. And so we have engaged in this partnership that we might not otherwise have even known that this was going on, these screenings. And then just a couple weeks ago, I got a call from the city of Greenville. They're applying for another federal grant and want to include an HIA as part of that process, and know that we have experience in that. So I just met with them last week before coming down here, and they're writing us in as a subcontract. So if they're awarded this grant, we'll have an opportunity to do our third HIA. So finally, some lessons learned is definitely that an HIA is something to really understand the ins and outs. You have to do one. And oftentimes folks say that HIAs are scalable, which means you can do it a quick and dirty HIA, or you can do a year-long comprehensive process. And the but part is that everyone's going to want you to do everything. And so it's really good to have a concrete timeline, and I'm really glad to have funding right now that is restrictive and has a definite timeline, because the scoping phase for our current HIA, we had 5 pages worth of health outcomes and determinants that our advisory committee thought we could look into. And we said, hey, hang on, we only have so much time, so let's prioritize. So we prioritized, we still did way too much, but it's just something to keep in mind. Another key takeaway for me is that there's a lot of science in HIA because it is based on evidence-based research and best practices, but there's also an art to it and a lot of focus on relationships and connecting the dots among different stakeholders. And the theme of what we've all talked about is why public health institutes are a good fit for HIA. In South Carolina, we do not do advocacy at the Public Health Institute. We do our role is a convener and provider of evidence-based information, so HIAs are a perfect fit for us. Now, the results of the HIA could be later used for somebody else to do some advocacy, but we won't be part of that process. Our role is to facilitate and convene the HIA. And then the next thing, everything is political. Of all the things I had to choose from in this comprehensive plan, I thought, oh, parks, that's safe. No, it's not. I've just lots of city politics. It's a city I've lived in for 20 years, and I'm astounded to the level of the minute details of parts of this process that have become political. And then, as others have mentioned, timing is everything because you have to have knowledge about when the ultimate decision is going to be made, and you have to have confidence that your partner or the decision makers are going to stick to their timetable, and that almost never happens. And then the time and resource needs are always more than you think they're going to be, just like everything else in life. So thank you. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them after Liz's presentation. Thank you.
Good morning. Maya, that was wonderful. I can so identify with so many of the things you said. Okay, I am at the UW Population Health Institute, and we are an independent institute but part of the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. And we're a fairly well-established, mature public health institute. So I'm going to talk a little bit about our project background and then some of the challenges we've faced and some of the lessons that we've learned. First, I'd like to thank our funders for this opportunity both to attend the training and then to be part of this demonstration project. So thank you to all of you for building this capacity. So our project is a transitional jobs project, a health impact assessment of transitional jobs. So what are transitional jobs? They are programs that provide immediate wage-paid employment and supportive services to those who have difficulty finding and keeping employment. They provide an opportunity for people to develop skills and experience in their local labor markets and a positive work history, so their resume building. And research suggests that participants in TJ programs may increase job security, increase wages over time, and decrease reliance on public benefits. Now, Wisconsin has in place a demonstration project on transitional jobs. This was passed by the legislature in 2009 as a small pilot project and then was expanded with the use of ARRA funds to statewide. So there are currently two-year contracts that are being administered by the Department of Children and Families, and they have 17 project contractors, and approximately 3,300 participants have engaged in the transitional jobs program so far. About a third of them have secured unsubsidized work since their experience. However, this program is going to sunset in June of 2013. This looked a whole lot better on my computer. Sorry about this. It's fading away. We identified three decision points that we wanted to impact. The first were the state agency budgets. The Department of Children and Families and the Department of Workforce both submitted their budgets on September 13th. The governor will submit his budget to the legislature in January. The legislature will consider that budget and pass it during the legislative session, and then that budget will go into effect on July 1st. So we had three points at which we could make an impact. So in the initial plan and in continuing conversations in the state about transitional jobs, the focus is really on poverty reduction. Nobody really was talking at all about potential health impacts. So we thought we could really add some value to that discussion. So we thought we could do this in three ways. First, we wanted to let policymakers think about what jobs themselves, the experience of work, could add to health above and beyond other ways of simply providing income support. So we wanted to sort of isolate the job piece. We wanted to look at health very, very broadly, not just about chronic illness, and but to look really at mental health and violence and community health and to try to broaden that discussion. And finally, where transitional jobs programs have been implemented nationally, frequently populations have been targeted. Ex-offenders, the homeless, and young people are typical populations targeted. We did not do that in Wisconsin. And so one of the bad things about the ARRA money going away is that the money will go away. But one of the good things is that the department will have, the state will have the opportunity to reshape the program in a variety of ways. And so we wanted to look to see if there were differential health impacts on different populations, and so perhaps advise a little bit about how that program could be reshaped going forward. So we put together a steering committee, and I was astonished at how easily very, very high-level people immediately agreed to sit down and be part of our steering committee. So we had high-level people from both state agencies who are administering this program, several legislators from both sides of the aisle, an advocacy organization, several community organizations, and some technical experts from the university. We were never able to get any business representation, although we looked high and low and tried to call in favors. And that might have been my first warning about the dilemma here that I was facing. Our steering committee ended up looking much more like this than the very impressive list of people who agreed to sit down with me. And what I realized was they didn't really want to engage and participate in the project so much as they wanted to keep an eye on us and make sure we weren't doing anything that got in their way. And so that was really why they were at the table. And so one of the lessons is, if this isn't brought to you by the community itself, there has to be a whole different level of engagement. And we did, in fact, our community advocacy organization was also very involved. There is a transitional jobs collaboration in Milwaukee who were at the table and who have an advocacy agenda around this issue. And so they were, of course, very engaged, but they had a whole different set of interests. And we had somebody from a community organization that at our scoping meeting wanted us to develop a system where we would do blood draws and then check for levels of stress. And I said, let's talk about the IRB and let's talk about the one-year project here. So, no. So that was all very challenging. And one really great thing that has come out of that is we did, in fact, develop a new partner out of that steering committee. The people from the Department of Children and Families has commissioned a professional evaluation, which won't be done on this project for at least another year. But they didn't have enough money to do parts of, to survey transitional job participants themselves. And so they were willing to sit down with us and really engage with them. And we said, why don't we do a survey with you? And so in partnership, they sent out the mailings, and so they identified all of the people who have, not all, but about 2,000 people who have been in or are currently in transitional jobs. We designed the survey and are doing the data analysis. It's a great partnership. We've had a lot of impact with them, and it's and a relationship that our institute really has not had with that agency very much. And so, of course, what happens in that kind of partnership is I think what's supposed to happen in the stakeholder engagement process. Their interests really became part of our process. So we were really thinking about health in terms of the workers themselves, but the Department of Children and Families, of course, is really interested in children and families. So we ended up asking a whole lot of questions about how much time do you read? Do you spend more time reading with your children? Do you spend more time eating meals together? Do you have your children's grades in school improved? So that's really shaped, I think, a lot of what we're looking at as a health impact. So what has this meant for capacity building in Wisconsin and in the Institute? So our goal has been to develop a multi-sector HIA collaborative based on the San Francisco Bay Area Health Impact Assessment Collaborative model. And this was sort of in development. And I would say that really the center of this and was in the Department of Public Health and the Department of Health Services. And they were leaders in the field. They had they were one of four states awarded an ASTO funding. They had an HIA network, had done many technical assistance and training programs, and had implemented some mini-grants. There were also some very effective nonprofits who brought some non-traditional partners to the table in this collaboration and a health equity lens to the process. And here we were at the university. Frankly, I think the minor player in this collaboration. We offered a variety of programs, and we had fellows and postdocs who basically contributed their efforts to the Department of Health Services and the nonprofits. But then this happened. This was Scott Walker submitted his new budget in 2012, and this is a picture some of you may have seen on your televisions or in your newspapers. And just to get a little closer, here's my husband, here's my then 14-year-old son in the window. The secretary, that I skipped a, oh, I'm missing a slide. No, it's the next one, okay. The Secretary of Health announced that the state would no longer be conducting any HIAs because they were a burden to business. So our friends at the Health Department said to us, can you please step up and take on a larger role? And we realized this was very important to do, that shifting political winds leave HIAs that are housed in state agencies very vulnerable. This can affect the screening of projects, limit their scope, jeopardize the integrity of recommendations and implementation, and that was especially true for policies that can vary in priorities as the revolving door of politics occurs, you know, particularly things around poverty. So we recognize that population health and public health institutes are consistent, sustainable, nonpartisan, and credible, and we bring many broad intellectual resources to this project. So we have tried to step up our role, and we're very fortunate to get this demonstration grant. And I want to make a little pitch. My colleague from Health Services, Jennifer Boyce, is here and today, and she's going to be talking later at a roundtable at 4:30. It's session 4385 on health impact assessments and effective collaborations. So we can talk much more about that collaboration. So for our institute, which has these three areas, this was a perfect fit, and it meets our mission to engage with real-world problems and be timely and relevant, to engage with our community and bridge public health and promote partnerships. It supports community health improvements, and it develops cross-sector collaborations. And this is the part that I think has been most important for me. I spend a lot of my job interacting with legislators. And most of them get in some abstract way that health happens upstream from healthcare. But it's very abstract, and talking about the social determinants of health means nothing to them. Health impact assessment is a beautiful way to really connect the dots for them about what happens, how what happens upstream really impacts health. So it's providing also many opportunities for us, And the one I want to really focus on, because I'm very excited about it, is I was able to leverage this project into a grant to do a teach service learning course to our MPH and PhD students at the university. And we're going to actually be conducting HIA. So as a training institute, we are going to be training a group of emerging health professionals in this technique. And we are screening projects. I'm excited to talk about that. So our challenges have really been the sustainable funding piece. If the state isn't going to commission, I'm listening to all of you talk about these state agencies and federal agencies coming to you with projects. Well, that's not happening right now in Wisconsin. So we have a funding problem about how to, you know, do this financially. And while the university itself is intellectually rich, and we have many content area experts, they also have reservations about this. They don't do a lot of political work, and the idea of best available evidence is not always something they're entirely comfortable with. They want rigorous, peer review, validated work that isn't always possible in these kinds of projects. Thanks.
A few minutes for questions, and I guess we'll ask our panelists to come on up. So we'll pitch it out to you to see what questions you have. Yes.
First of all, thank you all very much for the presentation. I had a question that I think was touched on a little bit in talking about what
I think it moved. Yeah. And did everyone hear that question? Maybe if you could repeat the question. Oh.
So the question related to how we communicate and prove that health impact assessments are a value add, and also to talk about not just the benefit to community health, but the benefit to business and growth. Did I capture that? You know, I feel like we still have a lot to learn on that in terms of the HIAs that we've done have not directly impacted businesses in such a way where we have needed to seek out business representatives on our advisory committees. Again, I think listening to Elizabeth's comments on this will be useful. I think that one of the things that we feel is important is that, you know, people in the community care about health impact, and they're starting to ask for it. Mm-hmm. And so in some sense, it's like, well, if a business person or a private firm doesn't have that experience about how to respond to people about health impact, hopefully they're going to reach out to people who can talk about it. So in some sense, they may come a little bit unwillingly to the table, but they kind of feel like, well, our clients or our community members are asking for it, so I guess we better get people at the table who can at least talk about it. One of the things that we are also engaged in Portland, we do a lot of work with our city planning department and working on our comprehensive plan for the city and trying to talk about health across the spectrum and the relationship between health and economic development and where they collide. And we're having some really interesting conversations about how you balance those competing priorities and trying to talk about how you kind of the tools you can use to balance them. And so we're really just kind of getting into those conversations. I think that's going to be an area where I hope we see a lot of growth in the field. One of the trainings that we are working on that's going to happen early in the new year, we are going to be training private consultants to do HIA. And that's going to be really interesting because a lot
lot of capacity has been built in nonprofit organizations, academia, health departments, and at least in our region, private consultants have not been a part of that. So I think we're going to learn a lot about people who think like business people, and working with them where sometimes we're not as used to talking in that language, the whole new language for us to learn.
Thank you. Well, this is we do have a lot to learn and a long way to go. And I think bringing business to this understanding of their role in promoting health is part of the answer here. And I know that our Institute's advisory board has really set for itself as a priority that kind of message and how do they engage business in sort of stepping up and becoming leaders in promoting population health. So that's part of it. I also think it's important to be able to say to business, look, our goal as HIA practitioners is not to stop a project. This is not like, you know, an environmental impact assessment where you find a snail darter and you say, stop right now, do not move forward. This is about identifying risks and opportunities and looking at mitigation strategy for bad consequences. We don't have the power to say stop the project. It's still up to the decision maker. We're just providing this information and potentially. So I think that message has to be made really loudly and consistently. Finally, you know, where we are finding, and one of the projects I'm screening for my class that I'll be teaching is a large land use project where there are going to be lots and lots of decisions about individual projects. And what we're hearing from some developers is, if we can put in things that are more health promoting and people, we may have a better chance of getting this project past the city council. We want to know what those things are. So I think you can also point out where it can be, where this information can benefit businesses. But I will also say that certain problems can only be solved at the ballot box.
Yes?
I have a question about health impact assessment and the environmental impact assessment or the previous environmental impact statement. And I know one of the parts that you talked about was around transportation and whether that's been not the only other year past experience with that. I wonder about what does health impact assessment bring to EIS process? What are the opportunities within that process? And what are the limitations of the process itself for doing the types of things that
you'd
like to see happen within
health impact assessment? So the question was about integrating health impact assessment into environmental impact assessment, and the benefits of doing that. And I'll say, from the start, Aaron Warnham, who's talked about in all these presentations about HIA, he's done the most work in this and has a great perspective on it. But basically, the NEPA enabling legislation is about protecting human health. And the practice of environmental impact assessment has gotten pretty far from that, where you look much more about, you know, air particulate concentrations, contaminants in the water. So it's, you know, it doesn't take that step to look at asthma rates, people getting sick from dirty water, whatever it is. So HIA really has the opportunity to be involved in this existing framework to get back to that idea of improving health through the NEPA process and not just being an impediment to whatever the project is.
What was the second part of your question?
What are the limitations of the EIA process or the NEPA process in terms of getting done or seeing the limitations or changes or interchanges of the project that you'd like to see when you're doing EIA?
I think so. The question said, what are the limitations? I think there's a lot of space within different EISs to get your recommendations integrated into those documents as part of the comment section, if you're able to actually work with people as they're building it to get more information in. But I think the biggest limitation is the perception of EIS being this big, onerous, litigious process. It's really, you know, funded by the decision proponents. It's somewhat seen as maybe not as objective as it could be. So then there's a lot of talk within the HIA field about should HIA, you know, should we target EIA as a way to get HIA, you know, advanced, or should it be separate? You know, ideally, we want to be able to do both. Mm-hmm. But it's about being aware of what that specific EIS project is going to look like. And if you think you're going to be making strong recommendations from a health perspective that won't fit in that timeline or won't fit in that process, do the HIA independently. But at the base level, it's the environmental impact assessments are supposed to be about improving health, so that's kind of the open door. But then you get into that bigger world that litigious environment that people kind of do want to shy away from.
So just a couple things to add. I think this is also kind of an example of the HIA, versus the health assessment and bringing health more to the discussion, because with the best practice standards of the HIA, a lot of times the EIS process is already structured enough that it really does seem like a whole other process which you are trying to put on that. So I think that can be some of the limitations of the EIA process, but also just some of the hesitancy about, bringing in health impact assessment practitioners to it. So again, I think language is important in terms of, we want to do an HIA on your EIA, or we want to help bring health more robustly into the analysis and the conversation. There are a number of resources on EIA and HIA, and you can probably just Google that, or certainly Erin Warnham, my colleague Steve White at OPHI, also has done some presentations on that, so I'd be happy to connect you. One thing with our streetcar project in the Portland metro area, which was on the draft environmental impact statement, we had a lot of conversation around, do we want to get this integrated into the EIS? Do we want a health chapter in the EIS? Or do we want to release it separately as a separate report as part of the public comment period? At the end of the day, we didn't have the option to get the health chapter in the report, but we also preferred to have a separate report again because it gave us some more of that flexibility. In terms of the project itself, what we found really interesting in terms of our evaluation and the lessons learned is that our metro regional government that was very close partners with us on this project, what they came away with was they said, you should have been involved way before we even got to the DEIS. And so in some sense, we learned that, whether it's part of EIS or not was maybe not as relevant as we should have been involved when the alternatives were being discussed that were going to have the DEIS put upon them. And just to address your comment about the limitations, I think the stakeholder engagement piece is a big one in terms of, EIS, the agency that's doing it has probably done a lot of them. They have their way of doing it. And to think that an HIA is going to come in and kind of take over that process of both stakeholder engagement, communication, can make people very nervous. Yeah. So we had success with releasing the report separately. And then, as I said, also some lessons learned about just getting involved earlier in the discussions.
So at this point, I think we're out of time, unfortunately, but let's give our presenters another round of applause, and thank you all so much for attending our session.